Wonderful music to cheer you up today. That's Arthur Blythe on alto sax, leading his band of very merry men with Down San Diego Way. James Newton on flute, Bob Stewart on tuba, my very favorite instrument here, James Blood Ulmer on guitar, Cecil McBee on bass, Jack DeJohnette on drums, Guillermo Franco on percussion. And it's from his 1979 album, Lenox Avenue Breakdown. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yutrith Lead, and it is Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories. You know what the deal is. You take the conversation wherever you want it to go, hoping, of course, that you are going to be sharing some very strident views. Of course, rooted in facts and statistics and logic and all the other kinds of things, but it is your forum to connect with the Lead Stories family and to engage in this wonderful trade that we have, and we trade in information, opinions, and ideas. So call 888-874-4888 and add your unique flavor to this wonderful boiling pot, this boiling cauldron of ideas, and see where it goes today. 888-874-4888. We start off in the city of New York with Joel. Hey, Joel, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Latrice, and how about you? How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there. I'm doing great.
Oh, that's
Thanks.
great. You sound wonderful.
Thank
Sound
you.
wonderful. If you don't mind, I'd like to reflect a little bit on Obama's address a few days ago. I think it was the 28th at the UN. I thought when I watched it on the air, I had a feeling. I kept thinking of Orwell's concepts of doublespeak and newspeak, because he defined democracy. That was really the theme of his talk. He defined democracy as a country that supports U.S. policy, and it seems to me that he was saying that if democracy had existed in Syria, there never would have been a revolt against Assad, and by that he meant ISIL, ISIL. Where there is a democracy, he said, there is no violence or revolution. So this was his threat to promote revolution, coups, and violence against any country not deemed a democracy. In making this hardly veiled threat, it seems to me that he redefined the word in the vocabulary of international politics. Democracy, from Obama's point of view, would be the CIA's overthrow of Mossadegh and Iran to install the Shah. Democracy is the overthrow of Afghanistan's secular government, of the Taliban against Russia, by the Taliban, I mean, against Russia. Democracy is the Ukrainian coup behind Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk. Democracy is Pinochet. As JFK said many years ago, it's our SOBs. He was referring to Trujillo getting, thrown out of the Dominican Republic. Now, a century ago, the word democracy referred to a nation whose policies were formed by elected representatives. I mean, that's what I was taught in school. And ever since ancient Athens, democracy has always been contrasted to oligarchy and aristocracy. But since the Cold War, Eutrice, and the aftermath of the Cold War, that is not how U.S. politicians have used the term. When an American president uses the word democracy, he means a pro-American country following U.S. neoliberal policies, no matter if the country is a military dictatorship or if its government was brought in by a coup, such as the color revolutions in Georgia or the Ukraine. A democratic government has been redefined simply as one supporting the Washington Consensus, NATO, and the IMF. It is the government that shifts policymaking out of the hands of elected representatives to an independent central bank whose policies are dictated by an oligarchy that is centered in Wall Street or the City of London or Frankfurt. And given this redefinition of political vocabulary, when President Obama says that such countries will not suffer coups or violent revolutions or terrorism, he means countries that are safely within the U.S. diplomatic orbit, free of the destabilization that is sponsored by the State Department, the Defense Department, and the Treasury, and countries whose vote is democratically elect a government or a regime that acts independently or even simply seeks the power to act independently of U.S. directives will be destabilized. Syria style, Ukraine style, Chile style, you know, under Pinochet. And as Henry Kissinger famously said, just because of a country votes in communist doesn't mean we have to accept it. So this is what was going on. And this is what I thought about as I listened to his really absurd speech.
Well, a couple of things. Did you expect any different from the president? You may keep in mind.
He's talking
not really.
Not really.
He's speaking in an international arena. And
pardon me.
I'm going to draw on the analysis here that we constantly have to maintain, perspective. This is a world convention, if you will, of leaders. In the world as a whole, the United States maintains that it is the leader of the world. It is the dominant power. So the president's attitude and the tone of his speech, which I thought was extremely condescending, because it is consistent with how the United States relates to the world. He is there, I described it very kindly, as a professorial attitude, that he is there lecturing everybody about what they ought to think and what they ought to put up with and how they ought to see the world, and they must see the world. He's teaching them, the whole world community of nations, he's teaching them how to relate to the world, how the world really works. And, of course, the way it works is that you go along with what it is he's presenting as his reality, i.e. America's reality. It was extremely condescending, and that's why I ran his speech and juxtaposed it with Putin's speech.
Putin's speech was statesmanlike in many ways, and certainly wasn't condescending.
It was not condescending, nor was it a flawed history. The United States maintains this position of absolute denial of any responsibility at all for anything that is happening. It claims no responsibility whatsoever. And here, so I'll have to ask you, in light of the recent developments in which the Russia has begun bombarding positions, ISIS positions within Syria, how do you see the speech now by both Putin and by Obama, since their topic is the speeches?
Well, you know, Obama knew what was going on. He knew the new policy that was being enacted by the Russians in Syria, even before he gave the speech. So the speech was given in light of this new knowledge. I think that a lot of the speech was, in fact, pure blustering, because I think Obama has taken the hand away from, I think that Putin has taken the hand away from Obama. And it'll be interesting. What I was really thinking about, you, Therese, as I was listening to the speech and thinking about, you know, what the consequences might be, I was wondering what would happen if, what if Putin proposes to airlift or ship Syrian refugees, say a third of the population, to Europe, and land them in Holland and England, who are then obliged under the Schengen rules to accept them? Or what if he brings to Russia the best computer specialists and other skilled labor for which Syria is renowned, therefore supplementing the flood of immigration from democratic Ukraine? Or what if the joint plans, you know, that were announced over the weekend between Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Russia to jointly fight ISIS, you know, which NATO has openly refrained from joining, what if that comes up against U.S. troops or even the main funder of ISIL, Saudi Arabia? So I think the game is out of America's hands now, and all it is able to do is wield the threat of a democracy as a weapon of coups to turn recalcitrant countries into Libya's, Iraq's, and Syria's. So The condescension that we saw the other day, you know, at the UN, is really a cover for really naked arrogance, and that arrogance tragically leads to death on an industrial scale.
Well, in fact, are you predicting then that in the situation where we are now, in which the United States is now talking about a no-fly zone and it has, quote, concerns, unquote, about the bombardments that Russia has begun in Syria targeting ISIS, do you expect that there would be an escalation? Do you expect that there will be, or there is a potential right now for conflict, armed conflict, between Russia and the United States, principally?
Well, I hate to be so pessimistic. I wish I could call you, Therese, and talk about some of the wonderful pastoral qualities of nature that still exist. I wish I didn't have, but I think we're heading towards a collision. And I'm afraid of is that we're going to see in Syria the beginning of regional proxy wars again, with Saudi Arabia playing a leading role. And anything can happen, once that occurs. And the other thing that, you know, we ought to be concerned about is that the situation in Eastern Europe, East Central Europe, continues to be dire. And the United States and NATO have just introduced enormous quantities of tactical nuclear weapons and missiles that are capable of firing nuclear chip weapons to the Baltic states, all the way down to the Adriatic. We're really in for a hell of a time. And with the economic situation really in dire straits at home, I mean, I was traveling across, I really could get off so others can call. I was traveling across the Southeast over the past 2 weeks, and we were in South Carolina and along the Atlantic coast. And I have to tell you, I've never seen so much poverty and so much despair and so much shabbiness. And you can see it on people's faces. So in the midst of this economic crisis that we all know is going on, this guy and the terrible neoconservative advisors that are around him and obviously influencing are really putting us into the precipice. So I'm really worried about regional wars firing up in the Middle East right now.
I think so. I think everybody else is. Thank you so much for your
You're
call
welcome.
Today
Have
and
a nice
getting
weekend.
Us. Thank you. Thanks a lot. You're listening to Lead Stories at PRN.FM. 888-874-4888. It is Free Your Mind Friday. Who is going to free his or her mind next? You're on the air.
Harvey from Berkeley here.
Hello, Harvey from Berkeley there.
Hi, wonderful you, Therese.
Hello, how are you?
Very good. Well, I'd like to talk about taking the profit out of polluting. And it turns out that the stock market actually profits from carbonizing our atmosphere. It's unfortunate, but the system works against us in that way. And we also have to look at the banking system, because they invest heavily in fossil fuels. Anytime fossil fuels is bought or sold or moved or drilling or mining, they finance it. So they would take, you know, they are one of the big scoundrels in the carbonizing of our atmosphere and the heating up of the planet, which puts us all in jeopardy, because we'll be like the Titanic, the water is rising sort of thing. And so we have to learn to, in a sense, preserve our planet. We have to put the profit into preserving our planet. And, like an example of how the fossil fuel industry uses us, they are they privatize the profits and socialize the losses. It's basically the theft of the commons. And our clean air, clean water, clean soil, that's all the commons, including us. We're part of the commons. And what they do is they freely use the air, for instance. They need the oxygen in the air to combust their product, but they leave us with carbon monoxide and other deadly poisons. And it says here, in California we have Proposition 65 that says, Warning, chemicals known to the state to cause cancer, birth defects, and other reproductive harm are found in gasoline, crude oil, and many other petroleum products or vapors or results from their use. So we're all paying the price while they reap the profits. And this is especially like the utilities, you know, the ones who use fossil fuels like oil, coal, natural gas, and nuclear, they're fighting solar like crazy because we, the consumer, bypass them. We plug directly into the sun, and we don't need their dirty fossil fuel-generated electricity. So there's a lot of energy trying to stop the renewable energy. In fact, the energy business is the biggest business in the world. I think the two biggest ones are food and energy. So there's a lot of money riding here. But, you know, we can't afford it anymore. We've gone beyond the limit, and we're in the danger zone now. So we really have to take on the technologies that, number one, don't use water and don't pollute. And we have them, photovoltaics, it's solar panels, thermoelectric, that's heat to electricity, piezoelectric, that's pressure to electricity, triboelectric, that's friction to electricity, wind, it just goes tidal power, it goes on, ground from the ground, vents, heated vents from the ground. So we really do have the ability, but the people in power, the coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear, they have a stranglehold on us and the economy. And so they've pivoted the economy to make it profitable to pollute. So we have to turn that around, and so that we aren't the Titanic, and that we can still float and replant our forests and make preserving our planet profitable.
Well, thanks for that. I want to ask you, could you give us an update on the impact of these huge wildfires that broke out in California? How are people recouping, and what's been the damage so far?
The damage is tremendous, and the perspective for the future is worse. Dryness coupled it's a terrible thing. It's all about the water, and there's no water. I walk around Berkeley here, and everything looks like it's just, the shrubs are drying out, the trees, the leaves. I remember there was an apple tree that I walked around every year, and it was beautiful with big apples. This year, it hardly had any apples on it, and the apples were all hard and didn't have much moisture in them. So we're under a lot of strain here, and the sooner that we reduce our need for fossil fuels, the sooner we're going to, the potential of perhaps stabilizing the climate. I don't know. We're all on tax here. We're all worrying that the future. We're all with no water, there's an incredible amount of stress. It's front headline in the paper every day about water issue one way or another. But water is the central issue here. And of course, it's pegged so closely to energy, like coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear are second only to agriculture in their daily uses of our freshwater resources. So that's another reason is that we have to turn to solar, because once manufactured and installed, solar energy uses no water. Solar panels, over the 20 to 25 years, they're warranted, and every solar panel should be given, I think people should be given water credits for the water they don't use while generating electricity and plugging their electric car into the sun. So that's the way
even
it's going.
But even at this point, Harvey, as the damage is being assessed as being catastrophic, really, is there some kind of a discussion going on that would help people understand what a different approach could be after, this is all taken care of? What will California's environmental position be in dealing with this phenomenon? Because it is also a byproduct of nature, where you have so much heat being generated, you have these fires breaking out. In some cases, you do have people committing arson and, setting fires. We do have that. But generally, it is seen as an act of nature. Is there some discussion going on about what will happen next, or how would the government or whatever apparatus that responds to these kinds of catastrophes, how would they deal with something like this, and how can people themselves deal with something like this?
One of the things to deal with this problem is that let's see here is that one of the things that I suggested is that they, you know, we have so much, we have over 800 army bases around the world where we're protecting, you know, we're the policemen of the world. I often listen to radio stations up around where the fires are on the computer, and they're often shorthanded. They don't have enough people to work the fires. And I think that they should bring some of our armed forces back from some of those 800 bases to more or less protect California and Oregon and Washington state's forests, because if we had more people involved, it would really make a big difference. You know, you could get a fire, you can take care of a fire faster, plus we can use Army equipment to stop those forest fires. One of the biggest problems about starting forest fires, Utrice, is lightning strikes. A lot of it is caused by lightning that comes down and hits the dry brush, and then the whole thing goes up. So it's the combination of light, you know, more than anything, I believe it's lightning strikes. There is the occasional tossing of a cigarette, but the majority of fires are just caused by nature itself. And it's a natural process, but, you know, with the drought, with the drying out of everything, it's really accelerated. So I would call for a portion of the armed forces to come home and be ready for next year's fires, because if you know, they predict worse in the future. And California, this is our fourth year of drought now, and I know that Washington State and Oregon State are also suffering under severe drought, and so their fires must be horrendous. So we need more help. We need more help. But I think that bringing some of the armed forces mm-hmm. back home to help is a very good start.
Thank you so much for your call today, Harvey.
Thank
Let's
you,
go
Utrice.
To Brooklyn. Brooklyn, it's Dave. You're on the air. Hello, Dave. You're on the air.
I've been dying to talk to you. I almost cried when I heard the news about you. And I almost had tears of joy when I heard how much better you're getting.
Yes, thanks. I'm doing quite well. I'm very happy about it, yes.
Have you heard about the UN Agenda 21?
Go ahead. Tell us about it.
I'm asking, have you heard about it?
No.
I don't know all the details, but I know it's really bad. It's worse than everybody
but
thinks.
But what is UN Agenda 21?
Well, you kind of hit on it when you had Gary on your show, along with this doctor. I don't know if it was with vaccines or anything. You stated to him part of depopulation. And he says, no, it's just greed. It's what I, a few years ago, came up with the hypothesis that it's herd thinning through profiting. Have you heard that before?
Yes, go ahead. Give us the overview, and so we can get into the discussion once you've laid it out.
Okay. This won't be easy. I'm not great at explaining things. We're purposely made sick, not just through vaccines, the dumbing down of the population through the water supply and the fluoride, not to mention the aerosol assaults of disguise that I see all the time here in Brooklyn, because I'm always looking up and I'm always seeing it. It's not normal contrails, it's chemtrails, which have, of course, aluminum, which is a neurotoxic to dumb you down.
All right, but first, if you can, Dave, tell us what is UN Agenda 21 and why you have concerns about it.
I don't know all the specifics, but they were talking about the smart meters, how dangerous it is to human health, how it eliminates the human electromagnetic field, which I'm sure you heard about, that all living things have it. Do you know about the electromagnetic field that all living things have?
Yes, but what I'm saying is that you called in today to alert us about Agenda 21, UN Agenda 21,
And that's not the main reason I called. I just wanted to bring that out because I heard it's really bad.
I've been looking at it. The little I know about it, and I don't know enough about it to discuss it in detail today, but sure. I know it has to do with a plan that was derived at the previous point. I don't remember what year, but I believe it's in the 1990s or early 2000s, somewhere in that period, where there was this global plan having to do with sustainable development. If that's what you're referring to, that's all I know about Agenda 21, and I can certainly take a look at it in greater detail. But I'm hoping that you can tell us give us a thesis of your discussion today, and so we can follow you.
I wish I was Jeff Brady. You've heard of Jeff Brady, who did I guess you heard of him.
Okay, So you have an idea about something. What is your concern? You raised vaccines. So let's talk about vaccines. Tell us what your concern is about vaccines.
Well, they're not really there to help. As I said, thinning the herd through profiting. They're there to make you sicker. Eventually, you're going to get sicker from the mercury and the aluminum that's in the vaccines. So the healthcare industry is going to profit through people getting sick and thinning the herd because it's going to die younger.
Are you take this position about all vaccines or some vaccines?
Any vaccine that has mercury and aluminum in it, because it's neurotoxic.
Okay.
Very bad for health.
And why would you say that this is a way of thinning the herd? What do you mean by that?
What do I mean by that? Because it's in the water, the food, and the air. And that's part of the UN Agenda 21. And they sugarcoat everything with a nice, pretty name to mislead you, like all government. Everything's misleading. Like everything you hear with Obama, it's all misleading.
Dave, you have piqued my interest in Agenda 21. So I'll take a look at that and see what Agenda 21 says in great detail. I only have a cursory idea of what it is. I don't, at this point, I can't discuss Agenda 21 in great detail because I don't know about it enough to begin that kind of conversation. But I want to thank you
either.
For planting the idea in my head. So you've planted the idea in my head and you'll follow through. Go ahead.
As I told you about smart meters, though, the guy who was actually showing what the smart meters do said they're not really smart at all. They shouldn't be called smart meters because it's misleading, like everything else. And I don't want to get too much garrulity into this. So I'm going to leave it at that and just
try. But thank you for piquing my interest in Agenda 21. I'll take a closer look. Thanks
just,
a lot.
Remember Robert Knight.
Oh, yes, I know Robert Knight. Thank you so much.
He's going to have some kind of memorial at the end of the month here in New York.
Thank you very much for your call today. All right, we go to Patricia next in New York. You're on the air, Patricia.
Good afternoon, Utrece, and greetings to the PRN family.
Thank you for that. I always appreciate it when people recognize we have a family out there.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And we're going to keep enlarging it.
Thank you.
Sure you know by now, but I wanted to share with the PRN family that the rank and file of the United Auto Workers did reject the contract, much to the surprise of Mr. Williams, the head of the UAW. But
we talked about that, as a matter of fact, on Wednesday.
I was in the library. I'm sorry.
I had a
huge project, so I've been sequestered in the library. Today was my free day.
Oh, good. Yes, we talked about that.
But what was really interesting yesterday, and usually in the morning as I'm trying to roll over in bed, I turn on the TV and I turn it on to CNBC, not because I have any stocks. I'm too poor for that. But you learn a lot about what the politics of the country and the world is by listening to people who talk about money. And so I listen to them every morning. And if you could have listened to them chopping their, you know, it was like they were chomping at the bits yesterday, because in view of the contract denial by the rank and file, the industry was talking about the spectacular months that they had had in the month of September. So, for instance, the contract talks was with Fiat Chrysler, and they had recorded 17.7 million sales of cars just for the month of September. And Ford, even though Ford had only been estimated to increase their sales by 21.9%, they increased their sales by 23% and GM 12.5%. And what the industry was saying, the point at which they, the number at which they break even, where they make a profit, the number above which is actually 10 million. And when, what they were saying is they are on a monthly pace to sell 18.3 million cars a month. And I said to myself, how greedy can you be? They don't want to share anything. You know, the profits goes towards their stockholders, employee compensation, not employee, corporate compensation, and,
correct,
and corporate profits. And I said to myself, I am certain when, so the plan is now, of course, to go back to the board and see if what they can do in terms of a contract that will be agreeable to the rank and file. But I said to myself, it is my hope that when Mr. Williams of the UAW goes back to the industry, that they demand that their fair share of these enormous and huge profits. Don't know what they'll do, but it certainly is my hope, because they certainly reported these sales with glee yesterday.
Well, this is why I've been covering the UAW negotiations, and from the point of view of the workers and what they are saying. And they have grave concerns about what has been happening. They described the contract worked out, or the tentative contract with Fiat Chrysler, as a concessionist contract coming after the bailout, after Fiat Chrysler has regained its position in the market, after the exportation of a number of jobs, after this two-tiered system that had been adopted, where some workers hired before 1980 were paid at a particular 2008, I'm sorry, were paid at a particular rate, and those coming after were paid a different rate, after the threat by the big three, Fiat, Chrysler, Ford, and GM, to look elsewhere to take some of their manufacturing plants outside of the country or in other states, it was a stick-up. And so it was not surprising, and this is what the story was when we talked about it on Wednesday, it was not surprising that the largest locals who had been voting on the tentative contracts just voted it down. Now, what is being looked at here is that as the workers at Fiat Chrysler go, the view is so will the industry, and it is heading toward a major confrontation, because as you know, at the beginning of these negotiations, they had decided that there were certain things that were non-negotiable items. The union apparently negotiated those items, and so the workers took a strike vote and authenticated a strike. They've given the union leadership permission to call a strike. Now, that's the next question. Will a strike be called? Because we're talking here about 141,000 jobs. And in a way, this was an extension of the discussion that we began about Detroit and where Detroit had ended up as an orchestrated plan to literally disembowel the entire city. So the UAW and the auto worker and the automobile manufacturers' discussions and this whole contract negotiation process is an extension of that plan about how does a city fall apart And this is what we're seeing. So it's all tied in together. It's all related. But I want to ask you, you're in New York. What does this have to do with you? Why are you interested in this discussion?
Oh, because I'm always interested in workers and the rights of workers and the fact that workers are mistreated all around the world. Mm-hmm. And if I had my druthers, I don't understand why unions are not unionizing and mobilizing workers all around the world to strike on the same day. I'm always interested in workers.
Great. Well, we'll keep you and everybody else posted, because I expect that in this coming week, when we should have a more definitive picture of what the vote is throughout the Fiat Chrysler world, because by then the votes should be in for all the locals that had voted on this tentative contract, whether it's a yay or nay, whether it's a strike, whether it's about the workers confronting directly the union leadership over the question of concessions made in the contract. And we'll see. We'll see where it goes. But it's going to be a tense week coming.
But, you know, Utrecht, what is surprising to me is that this should have been in the contract, the last contract, not this contract that they're talking about now. The terms of the two-tier workers that should have been eliminated should have been in the last contract. And for some ungodknown reason, the leadership did not put that in the contract, so the rank and file was not aware of it, so I have addressed it the last time. I'm glad that they are addressing it now, but it makes me question, you know, the veracity now of union leadership.
Well, it was part of the contract negotiations in the last four-year contract. The problem was that this is where the charge arose about concessions. The workers said that the union leadership should not have conceded on this two-tier question because, A, it affected a lot of people here in the United States, but more importantly, it allowed the auto manufacturers to export the same idea and with it the jobs. So as you heard some of the workers on the program, on Lead Stories, talking about the fact that whereas a unionized worker in an automobile plant here in the United States would earn, let's say, $30 an hour, that same worker was going to be earning the equivalent of 80 cents an hour in India. And there is, and we'll be following up with this discussion, there is a direct link between that kind, and I'm not trying to denigrate any worker anywhere, but we have, for example, with GM, the matter of these faulty ignition switches that have cost 174 people their lives. We have settlements, and we have all kinds of ways in which they were not held criminally liable for these things. But it has to do with the fact that the industry is getting away with a lot of stuff that when the unions were doing their jobs and vigorously representing their workers, these things were not part of the discussion as they are now. But the workers were very upset that the union conceded this issue, the two-tier system. And this is why they drew a line in the sand this time around.
Well, as I said, Utrecht, workers all around the world should be mobilized to unite and strike on the same day all around the world.
It's a great
idea.
I'm
serious. And then let's see what they do. Because all they're doing is pitting one worker across the road against the worker on this side of the road. That's all.
No question about that. Thanks so much for your call today, Patricia.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks. We go to Dallas. Sarah, you're on the air.
Therese,
are you there? Yes, you're on the air, Sarah.
Yes. Greetings to you, Utrecht, and greetings to the PRN audience.
Thank you.
Yes, Utrecht, I see that you're still with this hanging thing instead of you coming off of that branch.
I'm using the vernacular. I'm hanging, meaning I'm okay.
Yes, I know what you mean, but I'm trying to get you off of that hanging, because hanging and black people don't go together. That is something we should not want to put together in the same sentence. But,
What are you talking about today?
Yes, ma'am. But to what Patricia was just stating with the unions, and the unions have pretty much made themselves irrelevant in this age, because let's if we would go all the way back to the beginning of the unions with Gumpers, and that started back then when they were excluding blacks from the union. They did not want blacks to be any part of any union, any organization. They started that divide and conquer way back then. And then if you move forward up to now, where you find that the biggest participant in unions are normally black women, black men, and then, of course, you get the Latino group, and then whites are the least likely to join a union. But then they're the ones who derive the most benefits from being from membership in a union, starting from their position of authority, leading authorities in the union, that they end up getting, and they're the least likely of members. So this divide and conquer that they have, it is something that they're going to have to look at and see for themselves and do it, because we get played big time as being members of this union. And I can say as myself, as a person who have been associated with several unions, which is why I disassociated myself from them, is because the membership gets stuck. You pay your dues, and when it is time for them to take an active role and defend their membership, they always co-opted and work on the side of management, and you don't get anything. Because as you stated, with them shipping all of these jobs overseas, all of this was done under the leadership of the union. All of these jobs that moved off to Mexico, China, and other parts in Asia where these car manufacturing jobs facilities have moved off to, now the few that's remaining in the United States, they're making it seem that they're holding you over a barrel to say, okay, you've got to give up these concessions if you really and truly want to get this job, or are we going to move it out the country? So these are the games, and it got to this point now where you're going to have to make these hard decisions, because all along you played along with them and you allow things to get extremely out of hand as it is. But, Utrice, I'm diverting a little bit off of my main bone of contention from my Free My Mind on today. And one of it has to do with, I have to go back through the archives and I listen to your podcast dealing with Constitution and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, and you had on the professor from Albany State, I believe it was.
Yes, Paul Finkelman.
Yes, who was on, and he was given a detail of that. And one thing that we always like to say, these three amendments were written specifically for descendants of enslaved Africans in this country. And that same amendment, if we were to look at it, starting with the 13th Amendment, with the emancipation and the freeing of the enslaved Africans that gave us the freedom, that same amendment also have a conditional clause in it that stated, with the exception of you're accused of criminality, then you have voluntarily surrendered yourself for enslavement. Also, with the 14th Amendment, it also have to do with citizenship criteria for black males in this country. It has never been used in our benefit. Corporations have taken over the 14th Amendment. Corporations owned by white Anglo-Saxon males in this country, majority males, that have used that amendment to their benefit. So if we go back through, and we always see that when people give you something with one hand and they pull it back with the other hand, and they say, okay, we're doing these things for you, that none of those 13th Amendment, they have benefited black people, just except for your initial so-called freedom. And then, of course, which, of course, we know it was not free. It was neo-slavery, because you end up going back into a sharecropping form of slavery where you were still tied to a plantation. So these are something that, you know, that we tend to get all patriotic and we want to look at it, and everybody always want to tout that. But the problem that we have is that we don't read and see things that really pertains to us. And then we have these people driving up the fervor with saying, okay, that you need to vote, that this election coming up in 2016 is going to be the most important. And Utrice, if I heard that word one time too many, it's sickening, because I've been hearing that election with Bill Clinton and especially Barack Obama presidency, where they always said the same thing, this is going to be the most important election coming up, and we need to go ahead and get ourselves in line and get voted, because it's going to set us back. We've already been set back. Black people have never been, we have never been moved forward. You know, we always like to think that because you're moving around in a circle, then that means to say you're progressing and you're going somewhere. You are not, if you are playing musical chairs and you are just waiting for an empty seat to plop yourself into.
All right, so now I'm going to ask you the big question.
Yes, ma'am.
What is the alternative?
The alternative, you, Therese, is that we need to organize ourselves on a local level. We have more control on a local level as far as what our conditions are because we have a shorter reach and things that happen, policies, decisions that make on the local level, as a couple callers back was talking about the Agenda 21 and what it pertains with land usage and other things, those things are on the local level. These are things your city council that they vote on and you have a reach on to get a group of people to get them in line and to stop them from imposing legislative actions, things such as the smart meters, fluoride in your water, these things. These are things you have control of at the local level. You cannot do it. When Washington, D.C., you have no control in that madhouse because that's why, you know, the name should be, D.C. should stand for District of Criminals because that's what you have operating out there. You have no reach in anything at the federal level. Everything is at the local level when it comes to us. And that is what we are losing sight of. The judge, people who get put on these benches, as you talk about the Ferguson report and what's going on with the judges that you put on these benches, these people affect your lives in a much more immediate state. Instead of worrying about who's going to be put, oh, you got to vote for some Democrat because they're going to affect who gets selected for the Supreme Court. There is no guarantee that whatever president puts someone on the Supreme Court that person is going to vote in favor or along the same party lines as the president.
Let me give you an example. New York City, the city council, in fact, had been enlarged, I believe, to 53 members, and a large percentage of that body is African-American, Latino, reflecting the largest so-called minority or non-white groups in the city of New York. And precisely at a time that the city of New York has the largest number of people of African and Latino descent in the very halls of power, it appears as if their communities do not have the benefit of that power. So if it is your view that everything is local, explain, if you can, what happened there. Why is there this dissonance between the fact that you have a numerical increase in power, but you have no real evidence? And I'm not trying to say that absolutely nothing has happened, but you have no evidence that on a consistent basis, these people who were elected by these communities have in turn empowered these communities.
Because, Therese, the people that they elect are people that the party pushed, the Democratic Party pushed and tell them, these are the candidates, these are who you need to vote for. These are not grassroots people from the community that you know and you groom and you run them for office. We have allowed the Democratic Party to groom candidates for us, put the Democratic Party platform in these candidates' plate and tell them and then turn and tell you that the Democratic Party platform is Black or Latin or the Latino American platform. And we got it backwards. That is what has happened. And that is what has happened in all of these communities where we see where we have these majority Black or Latino or whatever constituents that is supposedly there and our situation is worse because these people do not represent you. They represent the political party that put them into office. And that is where we've got to turn this ship around. We've got to stop looking at people's political parties and you've got to start looking at their platform that they stand on. What they stand, does it represent me? Do I know these people? Is it someone that the Democrats are running and telling me that I need to vote for because we share the same skin tone? All skin folk is not kinfolk.
So now we are to part two. Part two is now that an entirely different approach has to be taken in the apparatus, the political apparatus that represents a community. You're suggesting what I've been talking about for years, which is grow your own leadership.
Yes.
Make organically grown. Grow your own leadership. Exactly. So how does that happen? How does that come to be? What is
You've
the process
got to
spot
there? People with potential U-trees that you know in your community, people who have done like grassroots organizing such as the homeless shelters, mentorships, and these things that have done these things without getting corporate donations. Because the minute that corporate comes in and they start offering them money to expand what they're doing, then they're going to be getting bought out. You've got to get these people and get them from the bud, from the seedling, and you've got to groom them from there and keep them away from these corporations, because once you start getting them involved, then you have pretty much lost control of any organic growing that you're trying to do. Because money has been the destructive element in politics, because everyone is telling you that you need because the minute that you get into office, you start running to collect donations for your reelection campaign. So you're not focused on what you need to do for the community that put you in office. You're focusing on pandering to all of these different corporations to get donations within which to fund your next election campaign 2 or 4 years down the line.
But this is a reality, though. You just cannot do a campaign without some kind of money. And I have seen myself many people who would have been fantastic candidates just not going anywhere because the community refuses to invest in these kinds of leaders. They refuse to fund their own liberation. They refuse to finance their own cause.
And that's true, Utrecht, because as Attorney Alton Maddox has always said, we are a people. We got stuff backwards. We pay for our needs, and we pay for our wants and our needs, or you know, vice versa. I'm getting them all confused now. But we don't. We always expect to get the most important thing that we're supposed to be paying for. We expect to get it for free. And you can. We cannot expect people to give their time and their effort for free. These things, you know, we got the money. Not to say that we don't have the money, Utrecht. We have got the money that we can do it, that we can fund these campaigns. But we seem to think that these people are supposed to give their time and their effort to us for free. But yet still, you're going to run around here and all these other candidates that you know, if you want something from them, you're going to have to pay them in order to do it. Like I was having a debate with a friend of mine that was upset because Dr. Claude Anderson wanted to come to their convention and he wanted to charge $5,000, and they're upset because they said he expect him to give it to free. I said, why should he give it to you for free? I said, if you go here, you get a white candidate to come into your convention and to make a speech and he tell you it's going to be $5,000, you're not going to quibble over that price. But because this is a black man, you expect somebody black to come to a black organization and to give their stuff for free. And that is something we've got to get it out of our head. That we, everything we want, it's supposed to be for free.
It's waiting.
That's exactly my point. And I take your point very, very seriously, too, and because it's something I've been saying for years. There has to be an alternative. It has to be grown. That's the work. Whether people want to recognize it as work or not, it is work. It is the work of politics, a new kind of politics. And it is, by the way, it is perfectly in line, perfectly consistent with the history of black politics. People organize their own systems, their own alternative systems, and it's the work that all communities do. Mm-hmm. When their interests are at stake, they organize and they fund their effort, and that's the work that has to be done.
Thanks so much for your call today.
You're so welcome, Utrecht. Have a good weekend.
You too. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. Really great thoughts, and I thank you so much for always offering your best and bringing to light things that we ought to ponder a little bit more, look into a little bit more. And this is the nature of Free Your Mind Friday. We're supposed to excite each other with new thoughts, new information, new ideas, and new arguments. And we do this with great respect for each other, and I really, really appreciate that. Thank you so much. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. I want to let you know I'll be talking next week about some things happening with me, seeing some good things happening, and I'll let you know about those things. But I feel good, and I'm following a protocol that keeps me feeling good, so I'm really happy about that. I'd like to interest the larger community, because there's a lot that needs to be done in terms of reorganizing our attitudes toward our health, and it would be good to share those things. So I'll do some of that next week. But in the meantime, please know from me, it is always a pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your company. And I thank you for that. Have yourselves a wonderful weekend. Surround yourselves with people who bring positive dimension to your life. Get anybody negative out, out. Do not have any negativity in your life, not even for a nanosecond. And we'll see each other on Monday. Bye-bye.